Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth, straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden, and I'm working
at... An Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage, as parents, for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Welcome. This is your guest host, Mark Poff, retired detective from El Paso County here down in Colorado Springs. So Chuck and Julie, I believe this is their last day of vacation. They're flying back today and they asked me to guest host. We're going to, just here in a few minutes, we're going to focus in on a homicide trial that my partner and I, John St. Augustine, and I both testified in back in December, or actually it was in November. And we're going to go through that a little bit. I think you're going to find it entertaining and somewhat enlightening about what I believe was overcharging and the zealousness of the district attorney and the police in trying to obtain a conviction, a murder conviction, on an individual. And we're going to try to lay out the whole case. And John's going to get on about a quarter after. And we're going to talk about that. There's tons to talk about. It was a great trial. The jury did well. It was just, I hate to say it was a lot of fun because I'm getting paid. But so to start off, I'm not going to talk too much about political because I know in the past, I'm not a political machine like Chuck and Julie. They know everything that's going on in the state of Colorado. I'm usually just so busy with the cases and stuff that I'm working on for the defense attorneys here in the state and throughout the nation, actually. I'm currently working on cases right now in Alaska and in Washington, along with Colorado. But you can't, and I tell Chuck and Julie this all the time. I sent Julie an email this morning saying, look, whenever you ask me to guest host, it always kind of jinx it that something comes up that is just really entertaining or some big news. And of course, over the weekend, there was some huge news down in Venezuela. We can go down there and start playing golf in Venezuela again, maybe in the springtime when everything settles down. But just want to throw out there, if there's anybody listening in and you want to call in, it's 888-627-6008. If you're Zoom, I don't think there's anybody on Zoom right now, but if somebody joins in Zoom, you know, you can just unmute, start asking me questions. I think everyone is still trying to get caught up from the holidays and everything. So we might not have too many individuals watching live, but hopefully some will watch the podcast later on, especially about when we talk about this homicide case. But so I have to mention just in passing, even though I know Chuck and Julie will talk about it on Wednesday, you know, we went into Venezuela and we extracted, arrested, detained, what, you know, placed in custody the president of Venezuela. Now, what's interesting is, again, the Democrats can't help themselves. They've got to jump in and just say, oh, Trump has violated the law. You've got to, only Congress can declare a war. Well, no one's declaring a war. It's kind of a legal matter being helped out by the military's helping law enforcement to basically arrest someone. Of course, they are going into a third country. But, you know, we did it in Panama. No one said a word. And Obama, he went into Pakistan, supposedly an ally of ours, and killed people and came right back out in helicopters with bin Laden. And nobody, you know, it's like, success, you know, we got bin Laden and everything. And nobody said a word like, hey, wait a minute, you know, you guys went into a foreign country and, you know, nobody cared. But because, again, you know, because of the Trump derangement syndrome, the Democrats can't help themselves. And so now they're actually arguing to turn loose Maduro. I mean, that's crazy. But, you know, the people who hate Trump. And they, every time Trump does anything, if he, you know, as I constantly hear, if Trump came up with a cure for cancer, they'd be saying, hey, cancer's good. You know, people, you know, if we don't have cancer, you know, we'll have, the population will be too large, you know. So they'll start arguing that it's good to let people die from cancer. So there's nothing that Trump can do that is a good thing. Now, from my standpoint, as an average citizen, retired detective, whatever, I think it's entertaining, to see what's going on in Venezuela. And now we're really helping Venezuela. Fortunately, no U.S. soldiers or individuals were killed in this action. That's a miracle, knock on wood. Hopefully that trend will continue. But I'm kind of excited to see that Trump is actually trying to defend the U.S. people. He's trying to protect me from illegal aliens that break the law, criminal law, by sneaking into our country. He's effectively shut down our border for the most part. That makes America a safer place. You can't have a welfare system like we have and have open borders, because anybody who doesn't want to work will just come to America and get on the welfare system. And sooner or later, as they always say, you'll run out of rich people to tax. So I'm all for what happened in Venezuela, even though I've said this in the past. I'm kind of like Rand Paul. I'm an isolationist. I'm a true, kind of a libertarian. I want to stay out of other people's issues. But when you start screwing with America by sneaking in tons of cocaine and other drugs, well, you better watch out, because Trump's in town and Trump's going to come for you. And I'm thrilled to see that. And I'd like to see more of that. So Mexico, I'm sure, is very concerned. Now, the country or the president who should be very concerned is the president of Colombia, because I could just see Colombia being next. We've already got all of our troops and our navy in that area. So, if we get an indictment against the Colombian president, that could be problematic for him and any Central American country. And what about Mexico? I wouldn't be surprised if we start doing raids in Mexico. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of legal issues to that. But bottom line is, you're messing with the United States of America, and Donald Trump is committed to trying to protect us and make us safe. The one thing you have to give Trump credit for is he keeps his promises. Now, lunatics will argue, no, he doesn't, and blah, 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 blah. He's like a true businessman. We cut a deal. You elected me, so I'm going to live up to my end of the bargain. So I'm sure Chuck and Julie will talk about that a lot more on Wednesday. Another interesting point that happened this morning that I think is very interesting is Tim Walz from Minnesota, who I think could be the goofiest dumbass I've ever seen in politics. I don't even know who to compare him with. He's a knucklehead. And I'm sorry that he's probably getting out of politics, because I find him very entertaining. It's like watching the Three Stooges rolled into one. He's just Larry, Curly, and Moe all in the body of one person. And he's very entertaining to watch. But if I lived in Minnesota, I would be furious that my governor was such a knucklehead and so stupid. I mean, during, his run with Kamala Harris for vice president, J.D. Vance just shellacked him. I mean, I think he even called himself a knucklehead in the debate. I mean, what an idiot. And he can't even load a shotgun. As an avid hunter, and he's trying to go out and put, show how much of a manly person he is, and he can't even load a shotgun, and he's recording it and they release it. I mean, that's what's really stupid. This wasn't live. He's just an idiot. But here's the point. Talking about Minnesota, because we're all, I think most people are surprised. I don't know that I'm actually that surprised. In fact, I agree with Trump from the standpoint that Minnesota is not going to be the biggest or the state with the most fraud. He's predicting California and I think Illinois, and I'm just, how can it not be New York as well? I'd be willing to bet that California is going to ultimately have more fraud during the COVID and all that time than Minnesota, because they probably just got boatloads more money. So now the cat's out of the bag. Everybody's the feds. The game is afoot, as Sherlock Holmes used to always say. And now the feds have rolled in to Minnesota and they're looking into this matter. You just got to think that indictments, federal indictments, are coming, especially if they sent money over state lines. That's problematic. That is a federal crime. So I wonder if Tim Walz, Because a lot of people, when they talk about resigning, and I used to be on a school board, and we had somebody who resigned and then blamed it on the rest of the school board. And my response was, typically individuals don't resign for other people's bad behavior. So if Tim Walz is well, he didn't resign. I guess I shouldn't say he resigned. He's just not going to run for re-election. That's kind of the midpoint cop out. He should have just resigned and walked away. At least he would give the lieutenant governor a chance to run as the sitting governor. But he's just too arrogant to do that. He should have resigned, but he's just not going to run again. So now he's the victim. He's the victim of all this, that his political career has been ruined. I got news for you. His political career was over the first time he ran out on that stage with Kamala Harris and just looked like, again, the Three Stooges. He just looks like a knucklehead, and he acts like a knucklehead. I think his career was already over. But why? So why does he pick now to say he's not going to run for re-election? I'm sure he was pushed by other Democrats telling him, you can't win. You got to get out. If you keep running for this and you get the nomination or to run as the Democrat, they'll probably have a Republican governor. So now they just got to get him out of the way. I just got to wonder, are indictments coming? Is there more to this? And Walz knows that there's more coming, and so he needs to get out of this. But to be honest with you, from my standpoint, I think Tim Walz is a little fish in this whole scheme of things. I think the person they need to seriously be investigating and try to indict if they can prove that crimes were committed, is against Keith Ellis, the attorney general. He's the one that, I mean, they have him on a recording, and you got to go listen to this if you can go out and find it. He actually says that if they try to shut you down, he'll get involved to try to stop them. And he even says that Tim Walz is in agreement with him on this point. So, according to this recording, Keith Ellison and Governor Tim Walz actually had a conversation about all this stuff that's going on that they've known for years is fraudulent. And they, through Ellison, actually, the recording, he's on the phone with the fraudsters. These are the people who I believe have either been charged or charged and convicted of this fraud. And here's a phone conversation recorded by the Attorney General of Minnesota, the top lawman in the state of Minnesota, who's saying, hey, if they come after you and try to shut you down, I'll get involved and help. And these individuals donated to his campaign. Gotta wonder, did they chip into Tim Walz? Did they chip into everybody's campaign to keep these people on their side? You've got to wonder, how big does this conspiracy theory go? As they always say, what did you know and when did you know it? So you wonder, and I predict it's going to happen, because here's the bottom line. They pissed Trump off. They went after him with lawfare, and he's pissed. So now it's payback time. And so when you do something now, all he has to do is sit back and turn on or get Pam Bondi, the federal attorney general, going, and she's going to go after him. And she's amazing. I think she's probably one of the best picks for attorney general that we've had in years. I mean, she's, as I always refer, she's a viper. She doesn't let go. She's a bulldog. And all you have to do is, you don't have to tell him, hey, I want you to go after these people. All you have to say is, go investigate this. And I think at some point, they're going to have crimes by Keith Ellison and Tim Walz, because I think they're both idiots, and idiots don't make for good criminals. And so, if you were going to be someone of low character or fiber or whatever you want to say, what's the best job you could have? Well, the attorney general, so no one will come after you. So I predict that you're going to see Ellison, that they're going to go after, or not go after him. They're just going to go investigate a crime, and I think there's a good chance it's going to lead back to Ellison. So I'm interested. I'm entertained. I want to see how this plays out. Now, I actually think the most entertaining thing that came out Saturday this weekend was my favorite judge, Hannah Dugan, up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, who got convicted of federal obstruction for trying to, and I see John has joined. Just give me another couple minutes here and we'll finish this up. So she got convicted of felony obstruction. I love this. Now, I have to deal with judges all the time, and I want to be straightforward. 99% of judges are great, fair, and try to stay the line. There are some activist judges that obviously Hannon Dugan appears to be, but she resigned. So she waited. It was obvious what she did. They have it on videotape. And if you get a chance to see the videotape, this is the case where the judge went out into the, she was notified. She went out into the hallway and told these federal agents that they needed to go down and talk to the chief judge because she didn't think administrative warrants were sufficient grounds to arrest and that they needed to go work it out. Well, all the federal agents went down there except for one who hung out outside the courtroom. And then he realized what was going on and he figured it out. Well, she actively, this is not a passive thing. This isn't something she did by accident. That person was there because he was charged with battery, some kind of physical violence against another person, a battery. And she's trying to protect this illegal alien and basically snuck him out the back door. Well, she was convicted in federal. She's a convicted felon. I love this. So she resigned on Saturday. Okay, well, you probably should have resigned a lot before then. And she wrote this letter, and I have it. I'm sorry that it's blurred out. And this one sentence, couple sentences, just really interest me. And so I want to read you. This is what she said, and think about activist judges. As you know, I am the subject of us un. Whenever I start going into this. I always get these words and then my brain just locks up. Federal legal proceedings, which are far from concluded, but which presents immense and complex challenges that threaten the independence of our judiciary. She thinks that this process isn't over. It's pretty much over. I'm sorry to tell you that. You've been convicted and we'll see how appeals go, but it's not going to go well. Because I'm pretty sure I know how the Supreme Court's going to rule. I am pursuing this fight for myself and for other independent judiciary. Okay, so what she's saying there is that she has immunity. You shouldn't, I should be able to do whatever I want. I'm a judge. I have absolute immunity. Well, they've shown that a judge can't walk out in the parking lot and shoot somebody and have immunity. You can't go outside your, or even in your courtroom and commit a crime and think that absolute immunity and we can have a conversation about judges having absolute immunity, which I don't think they should. And I don't think prosecutors should have them. And I think they need to redo all of the absolute and the other types of immunity that they have. But what she's saying here is not that she didn't do it. She's just saying that I basically have immunity and I'm going to appeal this and hopefully everything's going to work out. So I thought that was very interesting about what had happened there with this judge. And again, 99.99% of judges are great and try to be neutral in everything they do. So John has joined us. So Thomas, if you want to roll him in, that'd be great. So one of the things that we wanted to talk about, or I wanted to talk about and have John come on and talk with me about it, is a case that we recently worked on back in November. John and I both work predominantly for defense attorneys now, and I've said this in court before. Prosecutors don't want to pay for us because they can get experts for free. So why pay for John and I to be on their team when they can get experts for free? It makes sense. It's a financial reason. And I know that since I retired from law enforcement, I have testified for the prosecution down in Colorado Springs. So it has happened. But typically now, John and I, even though we call ourselves partners, probably one of the best advice I ever got from an attorney was when we told my attorney that we wanted to partner, he said, don't do it. He goes, just go into business, shake hands, and work with each other on business, and it'll go a lot better. We've been doing this for over 11 years now, and it's worked out great. John and I have a lot of synergies and our experiences, training, and stuff. So it's really gone well with us working together for the last 11 years. So I was contacted, I think, not 100% sure, because of me being on this podcast, being a guest host or being on the Chuck and Julie show. I believe there was an attorney that either saw me or whatever, got a contact or something, made contact with me and said, "Hey, would you mind reviewing this case?" And I was like, "Sure, let me review it." And I reviewed it and I talked with her about the case and everything. And I thought it was kind of an overcharging of this individual based on the facts of the case. So I agreed to join and I said, "Look, you got to bring John on. I can just tell by reading through the affidavit and stuff. There was some mistakes made during this investigation, and John is really the expert." We were just talking about this earlier. Our backgrounds are a little bit different, even though John's a double E by education. I'm more of a computer science, so we're both kind of technically trained in college. But John was the commander of investigations. He's run, and I'm going to come in on a low conservative estimate. He's probably run, supervised, worked on over 150 homicides, and I'm sure it's higher than that because during my career, I worked on over 80 homicides. But John focuses in on the crime scene stuff and all, and plus, as the commander, he had to kind of have the grasp of everything, where I kind of focused in on the technology. But another aspect of my skill set, if you want to call it that, is interview and interrogations. I'm a BSer from way back, a used car salesman, whatever you want to say. So I typically do well in interviews and interrogations. I had probably a very high rate of confession. So I got John on board. We reviewed the arrest affidavit, everything. We went through this. Definitely. So I'm going to try to go through this. And John, if I miss anything, please chime in. So what happened a couple of years ago was you had a young couple, and they went out drinking, which is okay. People go out drinking. Then they go back home, and she's pretty intoxicated. That's obvious because they did blood alcohol. And when they get home, there's an accident. So what happens is they decide the next day that they want to go to a shooting range. They both have handguns that they purchased for their own protection and the protection of their house. They didn't live in the best neighborhood. So they had two handguns recently purchased, have received no training on their weapons, had gone to a range a couple times to shoot the weapons. That's basically it. They're semi-automatic handguns. They're sitting in their bedroom. Shouldn't have been handling weapons after they've been drinking, but that's what's going on. So the weapon goes off, the one that the guy is holding goes off, shoots his wife in the back of the head, doesn't kill her immediately. It takes her about 4 days for her body to figure out that her brain's not working anymore. And so he calls 911 right away, tells them to get over here. He makes some statements while he's talking to the dispatch center. Cops show up. He shows them where she is. They get medical. She's rushed to the hospital. He's taken into custody, obviously. And I would have done exactly the same thing had I been the cop on scene. And he goes to headquarters, and then they do an interview and they sit him down for this interview. Now, at this point, John, is there anything that you want to chime in on about how I've forgotten just leading up to this point?
No, that's fairly accurate. They had recently purchased the weapons,
Right.
and the reason for that was that there was some burglaries that had happened in their neighborhood. So there was some definitely some crime that was going on in their area. So to kind of just give a more established background, they were concerned for their safety in their neighborhood and wanted the ability to be able to protect themselves in the event that, something were to go down.
Perfect. So he's at Adams County, and I'm going to say the jurisdiction. It's the Adams County Sheriff's Office. He's interviewed by a detective named Bishop, Detective Bishop with the Adams County Sheriff's Office. And he's willing to go into this interview. Now, there's some questions about how this goes on. Obviously, this interview is recorded, so I watched it numerous times. It's about 45 minutes long. But earlier there's some body cams where he's just asking about his wife, how's my wife? How's my wife doing? And then they make a statement where, well, you got to do the interview first, do the interview, And then, we can talk about you seeing your wife. Well, to me, I don't know that I really like that, but it is what it is. He goes into the interview room. Detective Bishop goes in there and says, "How you doing?" And he looks at him and goes, "Not well." He goes, "Okay." And then starts going into the whole interview. That's his whole rapport building, which is a huge mistake. And then he reads him Miranda. Well, understanding Miranda is you have to be very clear. When somebody says, "Do you understand these rights as I've read them to you?" They need to say yes. And then they go, "With those rights in mind, are you willing to talk to us now?" Which ultimately means without the presence of an attorney. He doesn't say yes. He says, "I have nothing to hide." Now, the courts have been very clear on this. If there's any ambiguity, I probably didn't say that right, you're supposed to stop the interview and just say, "Look, you just said you have no problems talking to us. You have nothing to hide, but I need to be clear on that question. Are you willing to speak with us?" That's a yes or no answer. And they don't do that. So to me, the rest of the interview is out. Now, for some reason, it wasn't challenged, or it was challenged, and the judge ruled that it was okay. I think on an appellate issue, that would be overturned without question, saying, "Look, that it was ambiguous." And we've ruled, the courts have ruled on this before, that you can't be ambiguous. So I had an issue with that. But just to go through this real quick, he tries to explain to him exactly what happened. He tells him that they went out drinking, they went to a couple bars playing video games and stuff. They run across some other people, and his wife is talking with them. She's being friendly with them and everything. And they get into a little bit of a, I don't even know the right word. I think conflict is too high. They, as a couple, sometimes you have disagreements. It happens. So they go home. He wants to go home because he has to work the next day. She wanted to stay, because she was having fun, because she was tanked. She was drunk. She was having a good time. But they end up going home. And then that leads into what I just basically said, which was they decide to load up their weapons, which is a huge mistake. Anybody who understands weapons, obviously, John and I have both been in law enforcement for many, many years. We've probably shot thousands and thousands, I bet over 10,000 rounds, probably a lot more than that. And we're very proficient with our weapons because we've shot them a lot. And people who just go out and buy handguns and go to no training are not proficient with weapons. And it's obvious during the interview because they ask him about it. He said, "Well, we've gone to a range two or three times. Have you had any formal training?" No. No. So these are all issues going into this. Now, during the interview, he actually makes a statement where he says, "Let me tell you what happened." That's a quote. "Let me tell you what happened." Because Detective Bishop is constantly interrupting him, trying to, I think, jam him up and get him to say statements. The part, and I even testified to this at the trial, the one interesting statement that was never made during that interview with him was, "Could this have been an accident?" Was, they never ask him, "Was this an accident?" During this whole conversation, it's basically, "How did you shoot your wife?" I mean, that's kind of like how the conversation goes. Instead of, "Well, we understand this might have been an accident, and we need to understand exactly how this accident happened." That never comes up. It's always, "How did this, how did you do this? How did this happen? Blah, 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 blah." And he finally says at one point, after Bishop interrupts him a few times, "Just let me tell you what happened." But Bishop couldn't help himself. And he keeps interrupting him. And finally they put a play gun in front of him and say, "Here, use this, fake gun and show us how you shot her." He doesn't say it exactly like that, but just tell us how it happened using this gun. And he kind of freaks out. He's kind of like, "I don't want to touch a gun." They're both armed in the interrogation room, which is not best practices. You don't interview somebody with your weapon on. You take it off before you go in, things like that. But he finally said, I want a lawyer. We're done." And they arrest him for murder. Well, not for murder, because she's not dead yet. So they charge him with attempted second degree murder. Second degree murder. That's knowingly killing somebody. They never even bothered to bring in, could it have been reckless, which would be manslaughter, or criminally negligent, which would be criminally negligent homicide. So to go through this real quick, sorry that I'm talking so much, John.
No, it's okay.
You got first degree murder. Everybody knows what first degree murder is. It's after deliberation with intent. Second degree murder is you knowingly kill someone. I point a gun at someone and I pull the trigger. I knew the consequences of what I was doing. Reckless is you're doing something stupid. You're doing something reckless. That could be manipulating a gun or whatever, and it goes off and kills somebody. That could be reckless behavior that caused the death of another. And then there's criminally negligent homicide, which is you did something negligent, which ultimately led to somebody's death. So they charged him with attempted second degree murder. And then when she passed away 3 or 4 days later, they didn't just amend. And that's one of the things I wanted to talk about. They didn't just amend, because you would think the affidavit for arrest should remain the same. Nothing's changed. They haven't talked to him again in the 4 days. She just passed away. So you should just be able to amend it and say, we're changing the charges to second degree murder. Well, that's not what happened. They actually took some verbiage out, so and edited the affidavit. So there was some concerns with the affidavit, which we do have some major concerns. So and we'll get to that. But John, I've been talking too much. So we both took the stand. I talked about the interviewing and interrogation by Detective Bishop. And then you talked about the actual crime scene processing. So kind of, if you could, and instead of talking about your kind of your testimony, just why don't you go through how they processed the crime scene and some of the things that you discovered.
Yeah, I think to start off, Mark, let's just get the elephant out of the room. One of the biggest mistakes that was made in the very beginning of this case was to allow somebody like Detective Bishop to be the lead detective, in this case. When you have these types of cases, it's extremely important that you put your most experienced people behind the investigation. And part of that, right, is at this point, she's alive, right? When he initially calls 911, he admits that he shot his wife, right? There's some admissions there. And so it's important that, right, as law enforcement, we're going to treat it as a homicide until we can rule out whether or not this is a potential suicide or an accident. Obviously, we know it's not a natural death. And so, when you look at the very beginning of this, one of the things, there's a reason why law enforcement has systems in place, right? We have, detective. I even remember Mark. When we would work cases, right? Hey, Mark, can you handle the people over at Big O, some of the employees or some of the witnesses, right? Can you go over to Monument PD and interview some of these people, right? You have somebody who's in charge of the scene. You have somebody who's in charge of making sure that everything from the hospital can be collected, right? So the whole thing here is that you have a crime scene, you have potentially a suspect, and you obviously have a victim. And the idea here is that you have to connect these pieces together, right? If it's a crime, and in this case, because he admitted to it, now the question is, like you said, is it a negligent homicide? Is it a reckless homicide? Is it a knowingly, did he knowingly commit it? Or did he premeditate or after deliberation, right? What were the things, what were the pieces of evidence that support whether or not, what we believe happened? And so what I'm getting at is when you have a neophyte detective working a case like this, they don't really have, number one, the experience, or, the training to really grab a case like this from the get-go and be able to, right, identify some of the issues that are going on in the case. And what is evident in this case from the very beginning, from the onset, is you mentioned there was a 45-minute interview with the primary person involved, right, who last saw his wife alive. That interview should not be going on for that short of a time frame, right? You're trying to establish as much as you can about their relationship, right, before this day, right, before the actual incident occurred. So you're trying to get a good feel of, right, well, what makes this guy tick? What makes him mad? What makes him happy? Right? What was his relationship with his wife? What is his proficiency with a weapon? How do we know about that proficiency? And so we're going through and we're really trying to understand, right, who this guy is. Also, what's going on at the same time, especially if you're the lead detective, is you're also trying to ascertain what is going on at the crime scene. So there's phone calls, right, that are made with either the supervisor or the detective on scene to give an idea of what is going on at the crime scene that would help in the right in the potential interrogation of this party. Now, what do we mean by that? Is that right? We want to know the layout of the home. We want to know where the victim's body was found. We want to know where a weapon might have been found, right? We want to know as many details as we can learn because when we're talking to this individual, we want to be able to know whether or not he's telling us the truth or he's lying. When you don't know those facts, you have no idea of whether or not this guy's being truthful. And so, what happened in this case, which was extremely problematic, is that there was really no communication between what is going on at the scene and what is going on with who's going to be talking with the very person who last saw his wife alive. The other thing that's not going on is we don't have anybody at the hospital to relay, right, what is going on at the hospital, what is going on as far as a canvassing of the neighborhood, right? You hear about all of these different shootings that go on across the country. And the reality is the reason why these cases get solved is because, you know, they do canvassing, they obtain video, right? They interview people. It's not just what they learn from a crime scene. You know, as an example, you know, that Brown shooting. Yeah, there's this shooting that goes on in an engineering building and multiple people are killed. And yeah, we have a crime scene, but who did it? The only way to really find that out is to talk to the people who are alive that were in that engineering building, around that engineering building, in the neighborhoods around the engineering building, as well as obtaining surveillance video to better understand if we can identify somebody. So it's, you know, it's as much as it seems chaotic, the big thing here is that you got to bring organization to the chaos. And the only way to bring organization to the chaos is to have experienced people who know how to deal with a death investigation to go, okay, who's handling the crime scene? Who's handling the canvassing? Who's handling the victim who's at the hospital? Who's talked to the doctors? Is there anything evidentiary value on her, right? We need to collect her clothes. We need to notate anything that we can about her. And then all of that information has to be somehow, right, summarized and given to the person who is doing the interview with the very last person who saw her alive. And so when that is not going on, it opens up so many holes in an investigation. And the reality of this case is that, you know, people like you and me, I think there's this thought, Mark, that we somehow work for the dark side and we're just out there to protect every guilty person alive. And the reality is it has nothing to do with that, and it's about accountability, right? Because as much as they want to hold the individual who's responsible for shooting this in, you know, this wife, this lady, this adult who subsequently ends up dead, right? As much as there's a responsibility to find out who's responsible for that murder or potential murder, there's a responsibility to law enforcement to ensure that they're doing everything properly and correctly, right? Did they get a search warrant to go in the house, right? But even before we get to that point, what I will tell you is looking at the body-worn cameras of all the officers who responded to this scene, it was like the blind leading the blind. We had medical personnel in that room, along with multiple de deputies who were all in there essentially doing nothing more than looking around, right? And looking. If you don't have a reason, like one of the very first things we teach in crime scene integrity is that you protect that crime scene. You minimize the number of people going in and out of it. So when you have this circus going on in this very confined bedroom where you have multiple medical personnel and multiple officers trying to make their way around this victim, the only thing that they can do at this point is render aid. They have no authority to do any kind of search. But what actually happens in this case is that when they're done taking the victim out of this room, you have deputies who are searching the room without a search warrant. And so when you think about that, right, one of the big problems is obviously they don't have a search warrant. There's a thing called our Fourth Amendment, right, which guards against unreasonable search and seizure. The government has to have a search warrant in order for them to search this dwelling. The reality is, when these officers, these deputies, were searching this particular room, they didn't have what we call paper. They didn't have a search warrant to search that room. But yet, they're doing things there. And what we don't know is what are they touching and what are they moving and what are they disturbing, right, prior to properly processing that crime scene.
Right.
Because at some point, they do get a search warrant and they do get someone to come over and process the scene. Now, to make it even more complicated, the person who processed the crime scene was somebody who had a very, let's say, credibility issues because that individual had an internal affairs investigation and she was subsequently let go from working there
Or she resigned
at exactly. It was either, I believe,
prior to the outcome.
right. And I believe she actually resigned. So,
And
but
I think she was
depending,
ultimately put on the what's referred to as the Brady list,
right. And the
which
Brady
is
list.
someone who departed from the truth. So her character was in question.
Right. So people who are on the Brady list, it's not just departing from the truth, but it's things where it may bring into question their credibility, right? So an officer who's involved in a DUI or an assault, or like you said, departing from the truth, those are all things that are potential Brady material. Well, what ends up happening is this person goes in, right, and she's processing this crime scene.
That's her job.
That's her job. And yet, what she could not recall are specifics of this scene. And yet, she utilized some newer technology. In the last decade, the Pharo system, which is essentially a 3D scanning of a room, right? It's able to essentially pivot around a centerpiece and be able to calculate where different items are inside of a particular bedroom. Well, she ends up using this Pharo system, but during the trial, nobody got to hear anything about what exactly was done inside of this room, other than she utilized a Pharo to do the room, but she could not explain the results of the Pharo because she had never done that before.
Certified.
Right. So here, it's the equivalent of you or me talking about DNA on a microbiology level about, what the DNA results would say to a scientist. And we have no qualifications to do that,
To do
right?
that.
So her being put in that position, right? What we're dealing with is a compounding problem, right? We have no systems in place to deal with what's going on at the hospital, what's going on at the scene, what's going on with witnesses, what's going on with canvassing. We have nobody who's protecting the integrity of the scene, and yet, right, we're supposed to go interview and interrogate a potential suspect without. Really, you're
Right.
operating in the blind. It's like flying a plane with no instrumentation and no visuals. You're literally trusting that something is going to happen.
And we did find out during the trial that there was evidence actually lost at the hospital. They admitted to that. They never got her clothes, which is something that you routinely do. And so probably I think one of the biggest issues when you talk about credibility does go back to this Detective Bishop, who was poorly trained and inexperienced. They even during my cross-examination by the prosecutor, they openly stated that this was his first interview of a homicide suspect. So that this was like he was new to homicides. And my biggest issue, though, and I had plenty of issues with his interviewing and interrogation skills. Is he lied in his affidavit? He put false information in his affidavit that he submitted for the arrest warrant, and that's a crime. And I hate to be so straightforward about it, but we caught him in a few things that he said that was not accurate, and some of the big ones. And so I have his affidavit for the initial arrest, which was for the attempted second degree murder. First, he says very clearly that the individual, after he read a Miranda, the individual stated he had nothing to hide, so he would speak with us without an attorney. That never happened. He never said that. And we have the interview on video. He never said that he would speak to us without an attorney. He just said, I got nothing to hide. That's it. So that's a false statement in his affidavit. And you can review the interview to see that. He says that on the drive home, this is in the affidavit. Well, he actually says also that at the bars that his wife became friendly with other males. And he says this, he puts it in here twice. But actually, it's three times. There it is again. That she's being friendly. So he's trying to lay out his theory, but unfortunately, it's just not okay, she's being friendly. So he's saying that when they got home, once inside the house, him and her continued to argue, and the play fighting turned into a physical fight. And she hit him with a closed fist in the head twice while saying he never lets her have fun. I don't remember where he says anything about her punching him in the head. That just doesn't come up. Now, at the end, and I'm going to read the summary at the bottom, he says that according to him, he is above average in his proficiency with firearms. That never happened. Never happened. In fact, when he talked to him in the interview about his knowledge or skills of weaponry or handguns, he said that, they'd gone to a range a couple times and more comfortable. They thought about getting some classes, but the classes were going to be about $250. They were going to be expensive and not in their budget. So he basically just said the only training he ever had with the semi-automatic handgun was they went to a range a few times and pulled the trigger. So that's the extent of his knowledge of that. So let me see. So here's the summary. I want to read this summary paragraph that Detective Bishop, and I want to be very clear on who it is, because I got no problem saying this because I think he straight up lied in his affidavit. Based on his recorded statements, your affiant, that means Detective Bishop, believes the shooting was directly related to an argument stemming from her, and I'm saying her because I don't want to put any names out there, being friendly with other males. Now, we know at the trial that the bartender testified and she said she was friendly to everybody, but he's trying to imply that she's friendly with other guys. Bartender said that's not true during the trial. She was friendly to everyone. She's just a friendly person. When they get home, he had them load up their recently purchased handguns. When she became frustrated with the inability to load her magazines, anybody who's ever loaded a brand new mag, it has a tight spring, and sometimes females have issues because it's hard. You got to use like your thumb, and so she became frustrated, and that's true. He did say that, and she threw her magazines and her handgun down, I believe, on the bed. So this is what he says, which enraged him, causing him to sufficiently excite an irresistible passion in his otherwise reasonable person, but it lacked enough time for the voice of reason to be heard before he pulled the trigger on his own handgun, discharging a round into the back of her head, causing brain functions to cease. This is the most interesting statement I've ever read in my life. Okay, he says this is the affidavit for the attempted murder. She's not dead yet, but he says that he shoots her in the back of the head, causing brain functions to cease, which would be dead. So now he's a medical examiner, and he says that he described his above average knowledge of handguns, so he knew what he was doing. Knowingly manipulated the trigger with enough force. There's no evidence to this. And he uses the word enraged. There's no justification for that word at all. He has zero evidence that this individual, that he got upset, enraged, and pointed a gun at her and pulled the trigger. That's what he said happened. The only thing he has is an interview with this individual who said basically, and he asked for a lawyer before he could really get the good information from him, but he did state it at trial. The gun had him confused. He didn't understand why the slide was stuck back and the trigger was stuck back. He was trying to figure out this weapon, but unfortunately, he put a magazine in it when he's a loaded magazine when he's trying to figure this gun out. But there's nothing in any testimony that ever suggested that he was enraged. And at the end, he says that he was, while being intoxicated from consuming 5 pints of Coors Light beer over a time frame of 4 to 5 hours, they don't know if he was intoxicated because they never drew his blood. I mean, so he wrote this affidavit saying that he was intoxicated. They could have done some math, even though it was 4 or 5 hours later, And he said the only evidence he had is that he had 5 pints. I don't know where he comes up with pints of Coors Light over 4 to 5 hours, where your body can process one beer every hour. So that wouldn't suggest he was intoxicated. So he's suggesting he's drunk. He also puts in here domestic violence. At some point, they suggested that he sexually assaulted her with zero evidence. And you know, he uses these statements that, you know, he was enraged. Obviously, he was enraged and he murdered her, second degree murder. So I know there's more stuff about the crime scene processing and all this other stuff breaking down. But basically, they had zero evidence that he knowingly did this. Now, of course, he's the only one in the room. So what you want to do during the interview process is you want to build that rapport, you want to get him to talk, tell you everything, and then based on what you were just saying, based on the totality of all this other evidence that we gather at the crime scene, other witnesses, friends, you know, at the hospital, all this other information that's coming in, you try to determine what are the inconsistencies with his statement, and then you go back in and you confront him with that to see if you can generate, I don't want to say generate, reveal evidence that this was a knowing, you know, that he knowingly committed this crime. That just never happened. But yet he wrote this affidavit, and you're not supposed to put opinions in there. Him saying that this individual became enraged, that's an opinion. That's not fact, because there's no evidence to back that up.
Well, and it would be different, Mark, if he had said during the interview, "I was really upset
I
and
was pissed.
I was mad and I would you would quote that, right?
Right,
You
direct
would put
quote.
that as a quote in your affidavit to describe what the subject said during that interview. You know, the other thing that I think is important to note here, and you know, whenever you know we look at a case, you always kind of have to look at the common sense approach, right? Like, okay, what are some of the forensics here that don't make a whole lot of sense. One of the biggest things about this shot to the back of her head is that this happened from 2 feet or greater away. Okay. So think about this, right? There's this enrage, he's enraged, he's upset that she's flirting, and so he shoots her. But here's the thing: he admits that she's still alive. If he wanted to kill her, why not pull another round and finish the job, right? She's alive, and she would be alive to tell the story if she were to live through this. If in fact it was one of these actions where there was some knowingly intent to hurt her. And you know, when you we when in this case, you know, we brought in firearms experts, we brought in forensic pathologists, we brought in psychiatrists, we brought in social workers, right? We brought you and I into it. And the idea is that, right, with these types of cases, unfortunately, right, they're very costly because you've got to bring in the various expertise to come in and talk about the things that are normal and the things that weren't so normal, right? Obviously, from a cop perspective, we have some chain of custody issues, things that weren't properly should have been collected but weren't collected. I know you didn't mention this, Mark, but something that was also extremely significant is a crime scene log, right?
Right.
You got Detective Bishop, who's the lead detective, who testified under oath. I believe that he said something along the lines that he was there 2 to 3 hours, but yet the crime scene log shows him there for 20 minutes at one point, and then 25 minutes at another point. Now that, in my math, that's 45 minutes. That's far from 120 minutes to 180 minutes, and so. Right, when you got somebody who has to, you know, embellish and lie about those things, you have to ask yourself why, right? And you know, I know that in the trial they didn't like me using this analogy, but it's a perfect analogy for these kinds of cases. It's like putting together a 10,000 piece puzzle, right? Even let's just say a 1,000 piece puzzle. The reality is that when Bishop was working with this case, he only had maybe 300 or 400 pieces of the 1,000-piece puzzle. And so what he tried to do through his narratives, like what you see in that search warrant that you just wrote, you read, the affidavit for the search warrant, he's filling in these gaps, right? The other 600 pieces or 700 pieces that are missing, he's trying to paint a picture to make it look like there was something, you know, more nefarious going on
And what was there?
but then what was there, right? And that's what causes people to lack trust in the process, is because you get people that are not telling the truth about what is going on. And unfortunately, right, our judges, when you have a police officer who comes into their chambers and says, "Your Honor, can you please review my search warrant?" And they review the search warrant, and then, they don't ask, "Hey, Detective Poff, are you lying in any portion of this thing?"
Yeah, right. Right.
Right?
They assume you're telling the truth.
They assume 1,000% that you are being the with the utmost integrity, you're being honest. And they
Right.
don't scrutinize that, right? They don't ask, "Hey, when you got the other warrant signed, did you omit stuff in that warrant from this warrant?" They don't ask those kinds of questions,
Right.
right?
Exactly. And actually, just to clarify, John, because we got to wrap this up in a couple minutes,
Sure.
the actual affidavit wasn't for a search warrant, it was for the actual arrest of him, and they arrested him shortly after the interview, which means it didn't really matter what he said in the interview. They were going to arrest him.
Right. But
It
that's the danger, right? I mean, and so
right. Well,
when
it's
you think about
confirmation bias.
it is.
And we deal with this all the time. And I dealt with this back when I worked in computer crimes, where a detective, we've both seen it, a detective's like, I know he's dirty. I know he did this. And so when they write these things up, like you said, they're writing it like a fiction story. You know, he became enraged, shooting a bullet through her head, ceasing brain functions. Who would ever say that?
Right.
I mean,
Right.
he shot her in the back of the head. That's all, you know,
And
you don't.
you can even have used a quote from when he called 911, what he specifically said. You could have quoted that,
Well, he
right?
said he shot her. I mean,
Right,
he
exactly.
said it, you know. And so just to kind of wrap this up, because so the jury came back and found him guilty of criminally negligent homicide. Which is the lowest option that they had. Obviously, he admitted when he testified that he shot her. I mean, so there was some culpability there from the standpoint of he made a mistake. There was an accident. And so, well, he just told me that Marine's on the line here, but we only have like 1 minute. Just make it quick, jump her on. Let's try to do this in 30 seconds. Okay, he says we have 3 minutes now. So yeah, put her on.
Hello.
Marine, you're on.
Hi, I'm John. Yeah, I've been listening. The only one thing I wanted to mention is you didn't point out a very important part of this case is that the victim's family bonded
Oh.
Ivan out of jail, and
Isn't
his 12 to 15 members of her family all sat behind him during the entire trial.
Oh no, I agree
And
with you.
they
Yeah.
even at they
Sounds
even
like
testified, right? Or
they
on
did, yes.
his behalf. That's a great point. Is her family completely supported him and knew this was nothing more than an accident, and the prosecution didn't even look at that. And that's kind of an interesting point. I'm glad you brought that up, is because during, I don't want to get into like negotiations, but basically the prosecution wasn't wavering on second degree murder, even though the family was
No,
like, we
not at
know
all.
this.
Yeah,
Go
yeah.
ahead.
No, I
Yeah,
was just
not at
curious.
all. That was the offer. Plead guilty to murder.
Yeah,
Right.
and obviously the jury did not agree with that. When they got all the facts,
No.
they made a ruling, a verdict based on the facts. And from my standpoint, I thought the prosecution looked pretty bad. And I think there was a statement saying that Detective Bishop wasn't credible.
Well, that's certainly what we said.
Yeah.
The jury told us that they went back in there and within 5 minutes said there's no way this is murder, all of them unanimously.
Right. So I mean, that was kind of where we were going to go to, but the problem is we took too much time explaining the whole case. Is that the prosecutors are supposed to be motivated by getting justice, seeking the truth and getting
Yep.
justice. And in this case, they wanted to win, getting the best conviction they could. But all
Yep.
right, so we have to go. I'm sorry, Maureen, that I'm glad you really called in to bring that point up that her family did support him completely. So I hope everybody enjoyed this and everything. And I'll see you next time that we guest host, and Chuck and Julie will be back on Wednesday.
Bye, Maureen. Bye, Mark. Thank you.